Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast where movie reviews are podcasted. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I don't need your nicknames, but you can call me nicknames if you like.
Yeah. Anyway, this time on Critically Acclaimed, you're reviewing a whole bunch of new movies. We're reviewing the new release from Pixar, Luca. Not to be confused with my cat, Luca. Luca, you want to help us review this movie?
Well, there are fish in this movie, and Luca is very fond of fish.
He does. He does like the fishies.
What else are we reviewing?
I am reviewing the new Netflix movie Fatherhood, the new Shudder horror film Super Deep, and the new it's a drama, right? Miss Juneteenth.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, we're reviewing Miss Juneteenth. And a somewhat lighter week sometimes than we're used to.
In terms of volume, perhaps. Yeah. And unfortunately, we've reached the point where the release of a Pixar film is now sort of a non-event.
Yeah, it's weird, right?
Yeah, Pixar was standing astride the world of animation for a while there. And
their films regularly were like billion-dollar grocers.
They were not only gigantic hits, but critically lauded and very well awarded and just widely beloved.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some think pieces published on the internet about how they've lost their edge because they made too many sequels.
Mm.
Somewhere around when they made Brave, it was clear that they were sort of taking influence from Disney and not necessarily the other way around. Some of their films are less interesting. When The Good Dinosaur came out, it was weird to think that there's now lesser Pixar and greater Pixar.
I think Pixar is simply cursed from the fact that early on they had a string of incredible hits. Six movies.
Okay.
And honestly, A Bug's Life, just okay. But we kind of cut that one slack because it was their second. But the string of Toy Story and A Bug's Life, which is good. I'm not complaining about it. It's just not their most amazing. And then Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, and The Incredibles. That list there. Astounding. Cars, a lot of kids liked the movie Cars. A lot of adults thought it was kind of pablum. Just kind of fine. But then after that, they went on another incredible stretch with WALL-E and Up and Toy Story 3. And then they did Cars 2. Which is cute, but not great.
So, as I've said in the past, they needed to sell more ice cream cakes.
Yeah.
So, they made another Cars film.
Cars is a multimedia monster. My God, they sell a lot of products.
Yeah.
But then they had a steamroller. And then they had Brave, which I still think is underrated, but I think was largely a victim of mismarketing, where they sold it as kind of this, like, awesome Braveheart with, like, a young princess as the lead, and it was not that. It was a terrible commercial for that movie.
It looks like it was going to be like a bit of a drama, and it was like a broad comedy, but in the Disney sense.
They're
making like anachronistic jokes and kind of like hip talking slapstick kind of stuff.
It wasn't even that really. It was a story about a communication issue between a mother and a daughter that was then elaborated upon and made allegorical through the use of fantasy. So basically, it was kind of Pixar's Freaky Friday,
right?
In a way, and I think it's cute. I like that movie for what it is. I think there's really good stuff in that movie. I just think everyone expected something else, and it wasn't fair. Right. Then we had, after that, Monsters University, which a lot of people didn't care for. Whitney and I are big fans of that.
I really love Monsters University.
I think it's very, very funny. I think it's got a really wonderful message for kids about how to deal with setbacks and failure. I think it's great. I think it's charming as hell.
And one of my favorite Pixar gags is when the monster mom is dropping kids off.
Yeah.
And just 'cause she's going to wait out in the minivan. She's like, you know, very prim Midwestern mom. Okay, you guys go out and have some fun. I'm just going to stay out here and listen to some music. And she rolls the window up and you hear it like blasting from inside the car. Mastodon. It's really fantastic.
It's a really good gag. Yeah. And then after that, there was Inside Out, which is generally considered to be one of their best movies, and I don't disagree with that.
I think it is their best movie, just bar none.
I wouldn't fight that too hard.
Inside Out.
I wouldn't fight that too hard. And then we had The Good Dinosaur, which has some interesting elements to it, but again, is just kind of a not very interesting production in some ways. I think stylistically there's a lot going on there, but anyway. Then we had Finding Dory, which is sweet.
Mm.
It's a good sequel. I like Finding Dory quite a bit. Then we had Cars 3.
It's actually a good film about disability.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And then we had Cars 3, which I think is the best Cars movie.
It's the best in the series.
I agree. I actually think it's another good one about dealing with failure. It's about dealing with what happens when you age out of something and you move into a new role. You're no longer the star. You become the coach.
And
that's good. It's good, actually.
It's also about a white guy learning to step aside for the more talented young Latinx woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Cars, it's not their most, eye-opening movie in many regards, but as a story, it's rock solid. Then we had Coco, which is one of their best films.
Coco, I defy you not to weep.
Yeah. Coco is a tear machine. Yeah, it's so good. And then we had Incredibles 2, which I'm actually not very fond of. I think there's a lot of conceptual problems with it.
Well, it's a Brad Bird film, and he has flirted very, very heavily and very openly with, Randian concepts of the exceptional human being, and that's kind of what those two Incredibles movies are surrounding.
Yeah, but beyond that, I just think there's just basic plot problems in that one.
Then there's also that.
Fundamental premise gets kind of lost. And then we had Toy Story 4, which most people love except me.
it's so funny.
I don't think there's good stuff in it. There's good stuff in it. But for me, what it boils down to is there's a new member of the toy family, and the new toy, Forky, tells everyone what his identity is, and everyone tells Forky that it's not your identity. Your identity is what we tell you it is, and if you're not that, you're letting people in your family down. Mm. And the ending of the movie is Forky happily going along with that. Mm. And I kept expecting Woody to learn not to tell people who they are. And no, the movie is about the opposite of that. And I don't think that's a crap message. So I kind of just got annoyed by the film.
I'm okay with it because it's a fork.
But it's an allegory. These are metaphors for everything.
I think it's
what a lot of Pixar works on is some kind of metaphor.
I think Toy Story 4 was them kind of goofing a little bit. The Ducky and Bunny stuff makes me fall on the floor laughing.
Very few Pixar movies don't have at least something good in them, and I think they're definitely fun. Then we had Onward, Onward was the first Pixar film to reach the real problem that Pixar has run into, which is COVID.
Yeah.
Onward is okay. I don't love Onward. I suspect it's because I don't have a particularly close relationship with my sibling, and I know a lot of people who have really connected with Onward say they connected because of
the relationship between the two brothers.
Because it's a sibling relationship that they felt illustrated something that they felt going on, and my brother is significantly older than I am, and we're just not that close, and so for me it didn't quite hit, but I can appreciate it. I know a lot of people really, really like it, but
I really, really liked it. I think it's just as good a tearjerker as many of other Pixar's movies.
Fair enough.
And, it's a little bit of an oddball premise. I feel like the world is a little bland. Like, the fantasy world they're trying to sketch out is not really imaginatively realized.
I think the idea that it has become kind of bland is the joke, but I think they took it so far that it's just bland.
Well, if they're going to, aesthetically make it bland, and everything's sort of, beige and colorless and sort of dull and uniform, but it just looks, it's like a boring sitcom version of the real world, and that wasn't so interesting to me. But apart from that, I liked the characters and the story and some of the weird humor in that one,
I don't dislike it, but it's, really low on the echelon of Pixar for me, just because it doesn't really connect to me personally. But that wasn't really the problem with Onward. The problem with Onward was it came out the week before the quarantine, and people knew it was coming, and people knew that there was a plague. So people didn't go out and see it in theaters. It had, the lowest Pixar opening in many, many years. And it hurt the film. How could it not? And so when the time came later in the year for Disney to put out the next Pixar movie, Soul, they just put that shit right out on Disney Plus.
Yep.
They just put that movie right on Disney Plus. And listen, the quarantine was still going on. And it came out right at Christmas time. And it was Christmas Day. And you know what? That's a nice gift for families. You know, there's a new Pixar movie. We can all stay home safe. And I think I'm not a huge fan of Soul. I think they didn't develop the idea very well, even though there's a lot of good stuff in it. But I think Disney has got this idea now that Pixar is for streaming services. Because Luca could be in theaters right now. It's in one theater. It's in the El Capitan in Los Angeles, and it might be another one in New York. I don't know. I assume they won Oscar nomination.
Mm.
You know, they cover their bases for that. But this could be a summer movie. Movies are starting to make more money. Maybe not as much as people would like yet, but they're starting to... People are starting to come back to theaters more and more. And Disney isn't doing that. And I think that's Disney's problem.
Yeah, I think
not Luca's. Luca is not an inferior film, and that's why they're keeping it out of theaters. I think Disney is just getting out of the headset of our movies have to go to theaters. Yeah, they would rather cut the middleman and get all the money for themselves rather than share it with a theater. And this, a new Pixar movie, will drive people to their service more than it's in theaters. We'll watch it again when we come home.
Well, also, the expense it would take to put, and again, we're thinking about like the company's perspective, which is, you know,
we're just explaining why this shifted.
A lot of context about its release pattern. But I do feel that the company, that is the Disney company, might be losing a lot of faith in Pixar. They're making money as movies, but like, how many Onward T-shirts did you see? How many Inside Out? How much merch did Inside Out move? Who got it?
Well, Toy Story 4 probably made a lot.
Maybe, but how many Soul toys were there? I mean, these are not they're creative films, but they're not the marketing bonanzas Disney is used to.
Soul probably isn't going to be like a Disneyland attraction, although Onward very much could have been. Onward could have led cool dining experience. Yeah. Go to the Manticore's restaurant or something.
I do like. I got to see Onward, and afterwards I got to see some of the merch, and because I saw the screening at the El Capitan, press screening. That, you know, that's there's also a store in the lobby.
That is the theater with the least comfortable seats in Los Angeles.
Yeah, beautiful ceiling, nice organ, but gorgeous. Yeah, the seats are terrible,
awful, especially if you're a big guy.
You might want to sit in the back because the row in front of you is like below your foot level, so you can kind of like spread out a little bit.
Yeah, but those seats were designed for very skinny people a long time ago. It's not,
and also people who were 3 feet tall. Like they're not, not designed for average height people. But I saw some of those toys, and it was like you could buy like the
van,
in the movie,
right?
You could buy the van. You could buy the legs. Like Dad is only legs in that movie. That was kind of cute.
Yeah,
but yeah, like kids weren't rushing out to buy those things. They weren't so inflamed by the marketing gimmicks. So I feel like Pixar is sort of like this prestige side project now, and they're leaning really heavily into the things that are making them money. And right now, that's Star Wars TV shows. And
look, every year or so, we'll get an Oscar.
Yeah,
that's what Pixar is at this point.
And now their attempt is a very summery movie called Luca. And Luca, the title character, is a sea monster.
Yeah, a mer-person.
That's the way they call themselves. They are sea monsters. This, with one little twist, this could have been Sigmund and the Sea Monsters movie.
Yes, it very easily could have been.
But yeah, he's a sea monster. He wants to go up to the surface, but he's forbidden because Pixar parents are nervous. And it's kind of like a running theme throughout their movies. Yeah. But yeah, his mom and dad are really nervous about him growing up, and they're overprotective about him going to the surface. He finds some surface things that have fallen down to the bottom of the sea.
Yeah, off of various boats, like an alarm clock or a playing card.
A wrench is one of them. And while he's out... shepherding fish,
which is funny,
that bleat like sheep. That's kind of a cute detail.
Very funny.
He runs into a sea monster wearing like a diving belt suit, like a diving suit, and follows this other sea monster to the surface. As it turns out, when he dries off, he turns into a human.
Yeah,
this is just sort of a natural, easy sort of plot conceit for the movie.
When sea monsters go on land, they can breathe the oxygen and they look human. But as soon as you splash them with water, whatever part of them you splash becomes sea monster-y again. And a lot of sea monsters know that humans don't like sea monsters and they choose to live in the ocean. However, we do find out things like Luca's grandmother occasionally will go to the surface and play cards. It's a thing some people do, but it is considered very dangerous because, as we find out, the small fishing village off the beach where Luca lives, which is in Italy, is very fond of killing sea monsters. It's a fishing village. Mm. Anything with gills, they'll kill. So there's a legitimate concern here. But they find like a dilapidated building just off of this idyllic tiny island where Luca and his new friend...
Alberto is the other,
Alberto,
sea monster.
Yeah, Luca is played by Jacob Tremblay. Alberto is played by Jack Dylan Grazer from the Shazam movies.
And Alberto's a little older, they're like 12 and 13. Alberto has been living in this dilapidated building by himself, talking about how great it is just to be sort of free and alone and by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You can hear right away that he was abandoned, and we do learn that later on.
Yeah, he's putting on a brave front, and mm-hmm. he looks, and to Luca, who has been sort of stifled by his well-intentioned and not horrible parents, but he's been a little stifled. Alberto seems like the coolest person ever. He lives on his own. He lives free. He doesn't have to like adhere to what society wants him to be. And he starts spending more and more time with Alberto. And then when eventually, I'm skipping ahead a bit just because the plot takes a while to get going. That's not a problem. I love the pacing of this movie.
No.
But just for the purpose of description, eventually his parents catch wind of what's happening, and Luca and Alberto decide they are going to go to the fishing village and try to make a go of it as humans and hopefully be able to get a Vespa so that they can travel the world. And that's the basic plot of it.
Yeah. So it's about sea monsters who want a Vespa, and that is so sweet.
That's so damn charming. I can't even be mad that the product placement for Vespa in this movie is like the most like blatant and hyperbolic product placement I've seen in a movie since Mac and Me and Coca-Cola. Like
I don't mind at all though, because this is they're going for Italian detail, and that they're hyping a very specifically Italian product.
Mm-hmm. It's an Italian company.
Oh, we got our superpowers from Lavazza. You know, they're trying to or Illy coffee, like something that is very specifically local. I think that's okay.
I have nothing against Vespa as a company. In fact, I once wrote a screenplay which also revolved around Vespas, like a long, long time ago. So I got nothing against Vespas. Vespas are cool scooters, as far as I can tell. I know nothing negative about Vespas. Maybe there is, and I don't know about it. But it is just a little interesting to have a film that is very, very sweet, very, very touching, very, very heartwarming, with so much name brand recognition. And not only that, but they don't just say we want a Vespa. They repeatedly say Vespas are freedom. and there are like these fantasy sequences with like Vespas and how magical and wonderful they are. And I'm picturing kids watching this movie and maybe only just finding out about Vespas and thinking, oh, Vespas are cool. And then deciding like one day when we get enough money, we're going to get a Vespa. And I'm not saying that's horrible, but I am saying that the company that makes Vespa is probably very happy about it. And I think that's something that's worth noting.
Yeah, I looked through the credits and there's no, like, they got permission for Vespa.
Yeah.
They're not like a sponsor or anything.
I'm sure that's probably the case, but I'm pretty sure that somewhere down the line, 10, 20 years from now, when the Luca generation grows up, Vespa will be raking in the bucks. That's all I'm saying.
It's a sweet story about the friendship between the boys. About their relationship. Luca looks up to Alberto, but Alberto also is very fond of Luca, and they actually develop a very good rapport. There's a really wonderful sequence early on where they go up into what is essentially his tree fort. It's like in the abandoned building. It's like, okay, let's see if we can build a Vespa. Oh, no, actually, I really got to go. And then there's a, like a hard edit, and like hours have passed. Okay, and if we, like, he's still in the, like, they're designing.
They're
okay,
so excited about this
now
project.
Now I realize I could go another hard edit. He's still there. That sort of thing. Like, they can't. I was reminded of the friendship between George Beard and Harold Hutchins from the Captain Underpants movie.
I was reminded of that too.
Yeah, they're kind of on the same wavelength about the kinds of things they like to create and do.
They've got their own world and they don't want to leave that world. Mm. And that's a really magical thing to capture, I think.
Yeah.
When you finally like find someone, and some people don't find this person until they're much older, an adult or even older, but you finally find someone who just the hours seem like minutes when you hang out with them, when you talk to them, or you're doing a project together, and next thing you know, you have 11 podcasts. You know, like that's it's a rare thing to find someone who's just on that wavelength, and to have that captured so sweetly and so beautifully, and with honestly just so much tenderness. There's so many movies about friendship, especially male friendship, which have so much artificial drama attached to it. So much just bullshit about people who feel like they can't be close. And I know attitudes in various European countries regarding male friendships are very, very different than they are in America. But in America, we get a lot of them where there's this weird antagonism.
Yeah.
You know, this constant one-upsmanship or something, or this constant, like, fighting.
Which is rooted in homophobia.
A lot of it is. Yeah, a lot of it is. Yeah,
we can't be close friends.
Yeah,
we can't be affectionate with one another because we don't want to be perceived as being lovers.
Yeah.
And for what, who, I mean, who...
A, who would care if we were, it's no, you can be affectionate with anybody. You know, you can say I love you to somebody. It can be, it doesn't have to be, and we make too big a thing out of that.
But because it's a film about kids, B, one of those wonderful halcyon summer movies where they're enjoying the intensity because they know that it has sort of a shelf life.
Yeah.
This is not going to... summer doesn't continue forever. Summer will come to an end, and there's going to be that tearful separation. Well, I guess I'll see you next summer.
Well, like, they don't have school. Camp. They don't have school, per se, but, like, there is this threat that if Luca's parents find him, they'll make him go live with his uncle, like, in
Uncle Ugo in the deep in the Marianas tragedy, we get to see Uncle Ugo. He's voiced in one scene by Sacha Baron Cohen, and he begins to... he says hello and then has a heart attack.
Yeah, because he's from the ocean depths, and so...
The pressure is too great for him.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Uncle...
Punch him in the heart. No, just punch him.
I appreciate that Uncle Ugo probably comes from a place of a whimsy and love. I also found him kind of frustrating as a fat guy joke, because he is portrayed as a big guy, and the first thing you see is his heart stopping, and it has to be, you know, and like the last thing you want to do is hang out with Uncle Ugo, who talks about eating food a lot. Mm-hmm. And a part of me was like, can we not with Uncle Ugo? Thanks. Like a little, he doesn't ruin the movie for me, but I'm not as enamored of him as a lot of other people are. I feel a little shade being thrown, but whatever. What I love about Luca is, well, I love the sense of place that it has.
Yeah.
I think, I feel like Pixar sometimes is struggling right now with how animated it wants its world to be. I feel like sometimes, like something like Toy Story 4, for example, where we've gone from the very block-like kind of construction of the original film to Toy Story 4, in which the environments are photorealistic.
Yeah, it's just the real world now.
Yeah, I actually think that for Toy Story, that's a bit of a mistake, because I think it makes the toys stand out in like kind of an awkward way, but sometimes it looks really beautiful. In here, I think they found a really, really good balance of occasionally something will look completely photorealistic, like the beach, but it actually looks like it's right out of like a travel log.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, it's a little too perfect, even if it looks real. Mm. And there's something just, I want to live here.
There's a bit of that Under the Tuscan Sun. There have been a lot of comparisons to Call Me By Your Name, which is also about an island in Italy where two young men form a very special bond. In Call Me By Your Name, they fall deeply in love.
Yeah, it's explicitly romantic. Yeah.
There's been the comparisons have invited some queer interpretation of Luca. Mm-hmm. I've heard some people call it a queer awakening film, and that's certainly some subtext.
Yeah.
The friendship isn't romantic. It's more of a friendship. Like, it's not explicitly romantic anyway.
Mm.
But it could very well be about the first stirrings of love for another boy.
It's good that the film can connect on that level.
Mm.
Part of me is still frustrated that Disney keeps approaching...
Coding.
It keeps a lot of coding. Keeps approaching queer characters and queer storylines, but terrified to explicitly say it. This one doesn't feel like they're terrified. This one feels like they're kids and they're just keeping it light and they're not really thinking about that kind of stuff anyway.
Mm.
And as a result, the movie can work on multiple levels, and that's really, really great.
It works, and even without queerness, it's still a fine film about friendship and warmth and summertime.
And I've heard it described as also, like, if nothing else, it is kind of a coming out story, because Luca is deciding that he is a surface dweller.
Mm.
And that's not being part of the sea. It's like, it's part of him, but it's not really his identity.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really, really great story to tell.
Mm.
And even if it is allegorical, and I think that is effective.
Well, and I also like there's a theme here about education. One of Luca's big coming of age moments is not just his friendship with Alberto, not just getting a Vespa for freedom, but he actually meets another character, a character named Julia, who teaches him that those lights in the sky at night are not glowing fish swimming above us.
As he had been told.
They're actually stars, and here's a book about the solar system. And he's fascinated by the way the world works, and he actually wants to go to school and ends up having a go back to school moment in the film.
Do I want to escape and have adventures on a Vespa my whole life? Or do I want to learn about the world?
Because the world is a big, fascinating place.
Those are both great fantasies. And they're both things you could do.
I really dug it. It's very sweet. It doesn't have gigantic themes behind it. It's not trying to unlock, the state of human emotions, like something like Inside Out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not trying to explore the nature of the soul or the afterlife, like in Soul. Mm-hmm. It is simply about friendship and growing up. And
I think that's,
those are perfectly good things to have in an animated film about sea monsters.
I think that's powerful in microcosm.
Yeah, I think it is.
I think that's something that, it's a film about the power of relationships. It's a film about how awesome it would be to live in Italy. Like, that's powerful to me, man. That's fucking great. But I'm really captivated by the whole look and feel of this film. I really do just want to live in it. But I love the characters. I think they're really, really sweet. I think the story is pleasantly simple, and I like that it takes a while to get going, because the important thing isn't I have to win this competition to get a Vespa.
Mm.
That's incidental. The important thing is building a relationship and wanting to while the days away without more of a goal than maybe we can make a Vespa.
Yeah.
You know, like, all of that is, that's just beautiful. Like, again, I want to live in this movie.
Yeah.
And I think that is beautiful. I
talked about this when we reviewed the Captain Underpants film, a film I'm unreasonably fond of.
I think it's very reasonable. I think it's one of the most underrated animated films of the last 10 years.
It's really, really good. Yeah. And because I have a young child, I've read all of the Captain Underpants books to them. As it turns out, in the 12th book, it is revealed that one of the two main characters is queer. There's like time travel in these books and all kinds of wacky stuff, and they go visit their future selves, and Harold Hutchins has a husband.
Nice.
And he and his husband are raising a child together.
That's great.
Harold's not ever, like, they never talk about romance or any kind of relationships at all, because it's Captain Underpants.
Well, they're little finding, kids. Like, they're not even thinking about that yet.
And they're finding, like, toilet monsters and stuff in those books. But Harold Hutchins is canonically queer.
Yeah.
When we reviewed that movie, I talked about sort of what I call the theory of the infinite afternoon, and that is the idea that from the time you get off school to the time you have to start dinner, maybe a two and a half hour period is where all of childhood resides. It's you go over to a friend's house, you make comics, you play, you come up with games, you play with toys, you converse, you come up with things that feel incredibly important and deep at the time, and is actually adding a lot of magic and love and texture to your childhood. And it's a 2.5 hour period in a day. It's actually a very small portion of the day.
Yeah.
But it is infinity. It is infinity. Yeah. It's where everything lives. So I call it the infinite afternoon. And I feel like Luca is the same, just for the summer. It's the infinite summer.
Yeah.
Where it feels like nothing's going to end. And when you realize it's coming down to an end, there's a lot of melancholy to that. And that's a very strong, powerful emotion when you're a kid. That sort of melancholy that the good times are going to end.
I think, thinking about it now, I realize that, like, I feel like I grew up reading Calvin and Hobbes comics, and I don't know if those comics are finding their way into people's hands anymore because the comics aren't in print in newspapers anymore, and I just don't think there is a live in the popular consciousness as they used to be.
They are kind of as a meme, not just, you know, Calvin peeing on stuff on the back of trucks.
Which is never canon, by the way.
No.
That was always a bootleg image. That was never even in the comic.
I would love to ask Bill Watterson about that. Like, I'm sure he hates it. No, he never wanted to market Calvin and Hobbes. He wanted the art to be the only thing.
I'm sure if he did, he didn't want that.
No. He was approached time and time again. Can we do an animated series?
Can we make a Hobbes doll, something?
Can we do some merchandising? And he always said no. He's like, this is not why I'm in this game.
Yeah.
He's the kind of guy who is like, oh, I'm feeling really stressed out. I just need to lie in a pile of sticks for a day. And I'll do that. I'll just sort of lay down on the ground outside.
Yeah.
Calvin and Hobbes, like, has been sort of memeified to the point where Calvin is... It's like this really kind of sappy, nostalgic strip.
Yeah, I don't know if
it never was that. It was actually a very angry strip.
Yeah, I mean, there are moments of sweetness and levity. But my point is that I always felt like Calvin and Hobbes, if you've never read it, is a comic strip mostly from the 80s and 90s. I think it was all the 80s and 90s. I can't remember if it was mostly 80s, mostly 90s.
Mid-80s to early 90s.
That was written and drawn by a cartoonist named Bill Watterson. And it was about a young boy with an incredibly overactive imagination and his stuffed tiger doll, Hobbes, who, when no one else was looking, was a real tiger who walked around on his hind legs and went on adventures with them. And they had long philosophical conversations about the nature of existence. And also they got into, like, adventures with cloning machines.
Which were always just cardboard boxes.
Yeah, it's an incredibly wonderful comic strip about child imagination, the things that children think about, and the things that we sometimes forget that kids think about, like anger and violence. Mm. Like, he would constantly, like, sculpt these, like, snowmen, but instead of having cute snowmen, they would be, like, snowmen that were trying to kill each other with snow shovels. Like, he was a creative child, you know?
He was incredibly creative. He's incredibly intelligent, but, you know, the character is sick, so he's not, like, misguided and selfish.
He's precocious, per se.
Yeah, incredibly selfish. He's a mean kid. He's mean to the kids around him. He's bullied at school, but he also is cruel to
Susie Durkins.
He has no friends.
Yeah. No, none.
Hobbes is his only friend, and that's in his mind. And he gets into fist fights with his imaginary friends.
So, and loses.
And he loses. So, Calvin lives a pretty sad life. There's a lot of rage and sadness in Calvin's life.
So I really connected to Calvin and Hobbes. And I feel like Calvin and Hobbes was always about the infinite summer or the infinite afternoon. Mm. And I feel like that's something where a lot of people have said, like, wouldn't it be great if we had a Calvin and Hobbes movie? I know I've said that a few times. And nowadays, I think that would be almost impossible to pull off. But I think films like Captain Underpants and of the very different but also wonderful film about childhood imagination and friendship, Luca, get it enough of it right. Mm. I think then, because I think what I was connecting to with Calvin and Hobbes was the infinity of childhood. Mm. And Luca gets it.
Yeah.
And very few other films about childhood do, I feel. And I think Captain Underpants is one of them. I'm sure there's a few others if I really push myself. But this is it. This is really gorgeous, wonderful filmmaking.
Well, and this is actually something that Pixar does a lot of. Mm-hmm. A lot of their films are about kids, and they understand a lot of the stresses and pressures of being a child. I think Inside Out is best at it.
Because it's really literally about nothing else.
Right. We're literally inside the head of the character. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Coco is about that, and Toy Story 3 in particular is about that, because it's about Andy growing up and the toys moving on, and sort of
it's about toys finding mortality, really. That's more about aging than anything else.
Well, it's about growing up, but it is also about, you know, these childhood totems need to, like, they get to continue the childhood while other people grow.
And you can look at Monsters University as a film about where childhood dreams go to die. College. You know, and about finding a new dream, but that's a very positive movie. It ends up being very, very positive about it, but it's something that people don't always tell you when you're a kid, which is that, you know, people always say, like, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? And what they don't usually want to say is, there's a really decent chance that won't happen, and you need to be able to make the most of it and figure out something else to do with your life and be happy. And that's what Monsters University is, and it's great.
My son is six, and of course we've asked him, what do you want to be when he grows up? And he's given a couple answers.
Okay, what's he got?
One, he says he wants to be a veterinarian.
Yeah, that's...
Which is pretty common.
When I was his age, I wanted to be a veterinarian.
Yeah, and I think it's also because, like, other friends of his that he likes also said they want to be vets, so he wants to just continue to hang out with
It seems
his
like the cool, popular job, yeah.
The one that made me sort of missed up a little bit, he asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? He said, I want to be a daddy.
Oh God. That's sweet.
Just like, oh God, I'm going to cry right now here in this craft store.
That's really, really sweet. He knows you don't get paid for that, right?
Pardon?
He knows you don't get paid for that, right?
You shut your fool mouth.
I mean, with love, yeah. I mean, I'm talking about...
But most helpfully, I asked him recently, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he just said, I don't know.
Good.
I don't know yet. And I think that's fine for him to not to know, not to have like a singular passion.
My
he doesn't really operate that way. So I think it's fine.
My dad always told me that he didn't know what he wanted to be when he grew up until he was in his early 30s.
Yeah.
There's no cap on it. You can totally change your entire life and career around at any time. So yeah, don't fall in that trap.
But I really liked Luca. I think it's very sweet. People are calling it slight, just because it's not like emotionally epic, but it'll still elicit a little mistiness. And I think the characters are very sweet and very kind and real to one another. And I really appreciate how gentle a lot of this movie is.
When people call it slight, I know some people are simply being descriptive.
Yeah.
But I also know that some people there's an element of critique in that, as though it's minor. And I think that's a trap. I really do. I think that's a mentality we have to remember, that there's this Western tradition of fiction that it's all about conflict and escalation.
Yeah, that's a bad lesson you get. You take too far from your first year of screenwriting.
Exactly.
First year of screenwriting, you're just learning how to do it.
Well, I think they're teaching you what sells in Hollywood right now, but what they're not teaching you is that there are many other literary traditions and storytelling styles that have nothing to do with that Hollywood tradition, and sometimes those things end up making huge money in Hollywood because they're different. Regardless, there are a lot of stories that are not about giant conflict. They are about... Most stories have some form of conflict, but they're about smaller things. They're about space and atmosphere and... A moment, not necessarily the shift. And I think this is about the moment. I think this is about this important moment in childhood. Mm-hmm. And there is a coming-of-age element to it, but it's more about preserving this. And I think this is really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really, really glad it exists, and I love it. And I have a few very minor critiques, but they don't really affect the overall takeaway, which is Luca is great.
Yeah.
Let's move on to another movie about the briny deep. I did not see.
Oh, okay.
The Super Deep.
And that's the title, is The Super Deep,
which is a great title.
It sounds like a wrestler to me.
It sounds like the sequel to that Jacqueline Bisset film, The Deep.
Oh, I never saw The Deep.
It's not very good.
I only remember the parodies and that Jacqueline Bisset wears a white shirt underwater. That's the detail I know about The Deep.
There was a hit film in the 70s called The Deep, which is about ocean divers who find, if memory serves, like a crashed boat full of, I think it's drugs? Or drug money or something like that.
I thought it was like gold or something.
Whatever, they find treasure in a ship and it leads to adventure and, you know... I actually find it to be very slow, frustratingly slow. And I actually think there's a quasi remake called Into the Blue with Paul Walker and Jessica Alba,
the two of them in swimsuits the whole time. Yeah. So yeah, it's like totally just an eye candy movie.
And it's directed by, what's the guy who always makes movies at the beach? It's not John Powell. It's John Stockwell.
Oh, okay.
John Stockwell, who, if you look at his film, he was an actor who became a filmmaker himself, and most of his movies are set at the beach. I think he just likes being at the beach.
Fine, more power to him. Just follow your bliss.
More power to him. Like almost every one of his movies that covers people in bikinis, and but that movie right there, for me, I prefer it to The Deep. It is pulpy. It is a B movie without shame. The ending is surprisingly fucked up. Like, Jessica Alba ends up getting, like, shackled to a dead body for the third act, and it's really, like, kind of twisted. Like, it's kind of cool, actually. But anyway, the Deep was a big deal.
Okay.
And now it's not so much.
The Super Deep is not about ocean diving or the beach or people in bikinis. It's actually a
lost interest.
It's a Soviet horror movie. Between this and Sputnik, maybe we are seeing the emerging of a new subgenre of horror films set during the Soviet era. The Super Deep is based on a real-life Russian experiment just off of the coast, or just off the, over the border of Norway in northern Russia. They are I forgot when it was put into effect, but
I don't know.
I think it might have been as far back as the 60s, but it's called the Kola Super Deep Borehole, and it's just an experiment to see how deep can we dig. They're trying to essentially bore through the entire Earth's crust in this big sort of scientific engineering experiment.
Like in that remake of Total Recall.
Is that, I thought they were actually mining. And,
No, well, they might have been.
Oh, but in the remake Total Recall, that's right, there was a tunnel through the center of the Earth.
Yeah, if you live in, like, England, you can go to Australia in minutes by just literally falling through the center of the Earth.
Yeah, and
stupid fucking idea.
The conceit of that movie is that, like, most of the world's surface had been irradiated, so there were only, like, two areas that were still safe, and the only way to travel through is just go through the Earth.
Sure.
That's what's important. I've heard dumber, all right? It's not so.
Okay.
Not so many.
All right.
But wouldn't you know it, a Russian scientist with a dark past... She gets word from the Soviet government that they've heard weird noises coming from the super deep hole. So you got to get in this fancy CGI elevator and ride it all the way down with some Soviet soldiers, because you got to bring soldiers.
Yeah, you never know. There could be soldiers down there.
Yeah, it could be something with guns. wouldn't you? Okay, I'll give you. I'd like you to guess. What they find.
How many guesses do I get?
You get three guesses.
Okay. Atlantis.
Okay. Second guess?
Hell.
Okay.
The gateway to hell. And an alternate reality.
Okay. It's far more mundane than that. It's more like aliens.
Oh, so it's the abyss. They just find aliens down there.
It's sort of like aliens, but it's also the thing, because what they find down there is
a
prehistoric fungus that infects people and turns them into like spore balls, and like it grows in their skin and they can't really feel it and they start losing their minds. And when it gets like a bunch of people together, it can kind of like rope them together and start moving around like a giant monster.
So it's Leviathan.
It's kind of like Leviathan.
Okay. Have you ever seen Leviathan? It's a surprisingly like...
It's an alien. It's an underwater alien knockoff.
Imagine the Abyss.
Like unashamed alien knockoff.
It came out like at the same time as The Abyss, because they were trying to like take the wind out of James Cameron's sails. It's The Abyss, except instead of like underwater aliens, John Carpenter's The Thing is down there. That's it. That's the movie. It's got a great cast: Peter Weller, Daniel Stern. Like, it's like really, really fun, gross horror movie. And it sounds like the Super Deep.
The Super Deep has a few fun, gross elements as well. There's some fun makeup stuff with the fungus, and you know, it digs into people and kind of melts their bodies and turns them into these like weird masses of fleshy plants. And it continues apace. It's incredibly predictable. You've seen this movie 100. If you've been paying any attention to genre films, you've seen this film or a film a lot like it recently. People are trying... In fact, it reminded me a lot of Sea Fever, a film that came out last year, a film that I actually really like, which is about people lost on a ship, and they become infected with little, like, worm-like parasites that invade their bodies and can kind of kill them. It's more like a disease in that one.
Yeah. I like that movie.
This one has a little bit more of a creature element to it, but it's the same kind of movie.
Okay.
And rather unfortunately, it's like an hour and 50 minutes long.
Yeah, that's kind of long for that kind of movie. Yeah.
Which means there's going to be a lot of scenes of people yelling at each other. The scenes where they kind of find out what's going on take a little bit too long to explain.
Yeah.
Rather curiously, it's dubbed in English, even though I think the actors were speaking English, because their mouths match the word, but it's clearly not their voices.
Interesting.
I think they might have...
Might have been for clarity.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. Maybe it was like... one of those things, or maybe some of the actors were speaking Russian and some were speaking English, like an Italian production.
I don't know.
It's just an element I noticed about the movie, that it's an international production. It's not specifically Russian. This needs to cut to the quick a lot faster. Mm-hmm. For a film this predictable, you need to either make it really stylish or stylized in some way. You need to do something really creative with the creatures. You need to come up with a more creative creature. Or you just need to get to the point, get to the violence, get to the gore, get to the horror of the matter. Because it's so slowly paced, it's not that scary. There's no like sense of mounting dread. We're seen at the beginning of the movie. We see a flashback where the main character. Let me look up the actress's name. She's played by Milena Radulovic. She has had something dark happen in her past. And it's shot in black and white, and it's just clearly it's kind of bookend material that was kind of sandwiched in to give her a little bit more of a backstory.
Yeah,
and it's. When we see these things, we can see the seams starting to show. There's a scene with a syringe where somebody like pokes the syringe into like a little vial of medicine and pulls out the medicine. And I hate when they do this in movies where they sort of they flick the syringe a little bit and then they squirt out like half of the medicine. They just spray it everywhere. It's like you're supposed to flick it to get the bubbles out, and then
that's
you
all it
push,
is.
And then you push the air out of the needle, so there's no, you're not injecting air.
That's literally all you need. You don't need to do a whole bunch; just a little.
Yeah,
like a little. And, you're done.
Yeah, and in this one, not only is the needle like something out of like a Victorian horror movie, like a Frankenstein movie, it's this gigantic cardiac needle. But that you can see they pull the medicine out, they hold it up, and it's only half full of medicine. Like the rest is like. Just an air bubble, and then they flick it. It's like, okay, like that kind of stupid detail really makes these little kind of things fall apart. And there's a little details about that of like the mechanics of the doors. It turns out like if you get the exit code wrong 3 times, you're trapped down there, which makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, I mean, you don't want just anyone not being trapped down there.
Well, I mean, clearly there's a lot of security to get down there. Why is there security to get out? I mean, are they...
Because, anyway, listen, everyone knows that if
they
you
might
were, like,
smuggle dirt out of
if
there.
You were
I don't
infected
know.
With some kind of alien virus, yeah. You would probably forget the password. That's their safe... I don't know.
So I'm glad that we're getting more Soviet-era horror, because it's something I don't see a lot of, but... Yeah. I wish it was a good movie. It was just really, really disappointing.
You can't have it all, dude.
Yeah, it's really disappointing. I wish they had done something with the characters a little bit more, given a little more care, like pizzazz, something other than just sort of something completely predictable.
I'm sorry.
Poo, I say. And I've been really impressed with and this is on Shudder. It's being distributed by Shudder. And right. Shudder has been doing a lot of really good work recently.
Yeah, or at least picking up good original films from elsewhere, yeah.
Yeah, I really liked Caveat. I know you weren't so fond of Caveat.
Couldn't get into it, yeah. Didn't finish it, though, yeah, so I can't critique.
Queen of Black Magic from earlier this year was really, really good. I loved Lucky. That's one of my favorite films of this year.
Skull the Mask is a great splatter film.
Yeah, and of course...
Just a pure splatter film? Really fun.
And I think Psycho Gorman is finally on Shudder. Yeah. So, and Psycho Gorman is also one of the best films of the year.
It's certainly one of my favorites. I had such a blast.
I'm seeing people in, like, Hunky Boys t-shirts now. Yeah. It's really fantastic.
My Hunky Boys! I love that movie so much. Some people can't get into that movie. I totally get it, but that is on my wavelength. That is my kind of film.
I mean, it's dirt cheap, but it's still fun.
No, but I grew up with dirt cheap. I was, I know some people like look at like certain kinds of horror and they're used to something glossier. Mm. But you know, I can watch we made it with a wad of chewing gum and like some fake blood.
Yeah.
And if you're creative enough, if you're inventive enough, I'm in. All right. I just want to have fun with you. That's all there is to it. Well, I'm going to take a big, hard shift from my next review. It's not a film about being underwater at any point that I can recall.
Okay.
Which makes it a little disappointing. But other than that, Fatherhood, the new film from Paul Weitz, who worked on American Pie and About a Boy, is kind of sweet, actually. This is a new film starring Kevin Hart. It is on Netflix. It's based on a true story, but very loosely. Kevin Hart plays a man who is married. His wife is pregnant. Mm. And at the beginning of the movie, he's a good guy, but he's really kind of like shying away from the responsibility. And when they find out that they need to induce labor a little early,
okay,
a couple of weeks early, that he hasn't even put together the crib yet. So he's just he's just not on the ball. He's not on the ball. He means well, but he's not on the ball. They have the baby. The baby's wonderful and fine. And then one day later, his wife dies from, I think it's an embolism. Mm-hmm. And his whole world is shattered, obviously. You know, mm-hmm. their life was just beginning together, and now he's alone. And on top of it all, he doesn't even really have room to grieve because he's got to be a father now. He's got a mom. Mm. He has a mother-in-law, played by Alfred Woodard, who is great in everything. And she doesn't particularly like him. And in particular, she doesn't like that he's alive and her daughter isn't. And who can blame her under the circumstances? It's not a very fun way to grieve, but it's totally understandable. And so she is trying to basically get him to move back home to Minnesota, where you have a family, and I can take care of this kid because I do not trust you at all. And so he's in a position...
Which seems, just from a practical perspective, like a better way to raise the child.
It's not unreasonable, and I appreciate that. And there's an early point early on in the movie where she makes a deal with him, and he makes basically a wager.
Mm.
And he says, if you can't do this, if you can't do this right, you have to move back to Minnesota. And he doesn't want to. His career is here. His friends, his other support network is here.
Mm.
His life with his wife was here. So he doesn't want to move. Mm. And I thought this was going to be one of those shitty wager movies where people make a wager and they bust their asses to do everything they can not to lose this wager with someone that they have a conflict with. And after a while you realize this wager isn't that important and I don't care about it. And fortunately they forget about it immediately. And it's basically just, he's being constantly encouraged to, you can fail, but he doesn't want to, he wants to succeed. And so he ends up raising a baby along with a couple of his friends from work, played by Lil Rel Howery.
Okay.
And I think it's Anthony Carrigan plays. Yeah, Anthony Carrigan plays his other friend. And Paul Reiser, who I haven't seen in a movie in a while, plays his boss.
Okay.
And Paul Reiser is a pretty well-intentioned boss. And I was worried, again, there's another cliche it sidesteps where it's you can't have your child in here. This is an office. And Paul Reiser is just actually pretty cool about it.
Mm.
He's actually just he tries to be sympathetic and everything, but he doesn't really have an experience of losing a wife.
Yeah.
So it's oh yeah, I lost an aunt once. She was 99, and it was just devastating. And Kevin Hart's yeah, it sounds rough.
That's
yeah,
yeah, totally the same thing.
Yeah, totally, totally the same. But there's a whole bit where Kevin Hart's bringing the baby to the office and it's becoming a distraction. And Paul Reiser's just you've heard of babysitters, right? Has anyone told you about babysitters? Do you know? Mm. Because it's just about getting this guy some support to be a decent dad. And that's a lot of the movie.
Mm.
It's just him trying to be a decent dad. And he's not awful at it. You know, there's problems. There's colic. You know, there's...
Is this one of those films where... it's about machismo?
No, okay. And I'm so glad it's not. Okay. Honestly, one of the most remarkable things about this movie, maybe the most remarkable thing about this movie, is what it's not.
Okay.
It avoids what you would call the dippy dad syndrome. Yeah. We're like, oh, poop, how am I going to handle poop? I'm going to clean it up. I don't like it.
Men do not know how to be parents. Yeah.
He doesn't because he's never done it before, but he's actually doing, he figures it out.
Yeah.
People, you know, I have an anxiety about the possibility of being a parent someday, and because I'm constantly terrified I'd screw it up. But you know what actually makes me feel it's possible? Look at all the people out there. Someone figured it out. I know people who are idiots. All right, and they've had kids. Not everyone I know who has had kids is an idiot, but we've all know people who it's just you can barely change a light bulb. How did you raise cool kids? How did you do that? It's love and attention. It's you can do it. You know, you can make mistakes and figure it out. So it's about making mistakes and figuring it out. And then it cuts ahead and the girl's in elementary school and he's finally got just enough wiggle room where she's at school and figuring things out and he might be able to start dating again.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that's actually where the movie starts getting a little more interesting. I was worried it would lose me.
Okay.
And then you start realizing a couple of things. One, Kevin Hart has some seriously undiagnosed PTSD from losing his wife.
Okay.
And it has prevented him from pursuing his own life. He's living for his daughter, and anything else fills in with a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
And
there's another connection with Pixar there, isn't it?
Yeah.
The nervous parent.
Yeah, well, sure. But like, but you totally get it here. There's this great bit in the movie. It's actually maybe the most effective establishing shot I've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the beginning of the movie, when Kevin Hart's wife dies, we see, like, they're at a hospital, and there's a very distinct establishing shot of the hospital. It's not, like, fascinating, but it's very clearly, you remember the shot.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, when he's dating someone, and he's out on a date while his daughter is at school, thinking everything is fine, and he doesn't realize until it's been a couple of hours that the school is called 19 times and his daughter fell off a jungle gym and hit her head.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
So he feels awful. And of course, this makes him not want to ever date again and almost ruins his relationship. But the thing that is so brilliant about it is when he finds out and he's going to go to the hospital to see her, they use the same establishing shot of the same hospital. And you realize that this is very triggering for him.
Yeah.
That not only could he is someone, one of the people that he loves, in physical peril, but they're at this hospital.
Yeah.
And the last time he was at this hospital, his wife died. And you can see why he's overreacting mm-hmm. to a lot of this, but you totally get every single part of it. So there's a lot of like really subtle thoughtfulness going on here, which I really, really like. Mm-hmm. The movie never really has gigantic peaks and valleys.
Okay.
It's about mild.
Mm-hmm.
It is about being reassuring. It is about how fatherhood is possible. It's about how moving on is possible. It's about how positive family relationships can happen, even in adverse circumstances. It's all supposed to make you feel good at the end, but it doesn't try to make you feel implausibly good. And I think that's its success story. It's not like Yes Day or something where it's just like, yay, the whole family managed to make it at this rock concert. And, you know, like, yeah, we're all great together.
It's really contrived, feel good Hollywood moments.
It's not contrived. It's actually just down to earth and sweet. I think Kevin Hart is at his best when he doesn't have to try. So much of Kevin Hart's career as an actor is him trying to make the most of it, or trying to get your attention, or trying to entertain you, like, hard.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's what the material asks of him. Sometimes the material is so bad, that's all he can do. But when he can actually take a load off and be real, he's a very affable actor. And I think this is actually him at his best, because he's not trying to be funny. He doesn't need to be loud. He is funny, but he's funny without, you know, putting on a show. And I think this is actually the best of Kevin Hart.
Okay.
At least as an actor. I like this. I don't love it, but it's a sweet film. It got me in the feels. I don't have anything particularly negative to say about it. It's a nicely handled, mild family movie, and good. We need more of them.
Yeah.
So, I liked it.
I like films that shoot for like real emotional moments that you have in your life rather than trying to orchestrate large moments.
Yeah.
I feel the same way about Luca. I mean, Luca is an animated fantasy film, but it is about something a little bit more down to earth.
Yeah.
It sounds like something similar is going on with fatherhood.
I mean, I guess
no sea monsters, but
I guess it wouldn't be the worst double feature ever. Like one's more about the focus on a kid's experience, one's more focused on a parent's experience.
Mm-hmm.
There actually is a nice subplot. I don't particularly care for the way it resolves, but there's a subplot where Kevin Hart takes his daughter to this school, and it's a Catholic school. No, it is a Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a dress code. She's supposed to wear skirts, but she doesn't want to. She wants to wear pants. And he lets her wear pants because she wants to wear pants. But some of the like the family members in her life say, you know, she should have a female influence around her, you know, because that's part of the childhood experience. But mostly people just say, listen to what your daughter wants. And my daughter wants to wear pants. I'm going to let her wear pants.
Mm.
So like, but then the school is just like, you have to wear this skirt and everything like that. So there's a bit of identity being discussed here, but we don't go into any more detail than Luca does. Yeah, yeah. So, but yeah, it's a nice conversation to have, and I think they come to a reasonably okay conclusion with it. I just don't think they really stuck that particular landing, because that's kind of a can of worms, and the way that the school is trying to impose their will is, I think, a bigger issue than the movie kind of realizes.
Yeah.
So I think that's maybe the part that gets whiffed a little bit, but it doesn't hurt the movie overall. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So that's Fatherhood. And then tell me about Miss Juneteenth.
Miss Juneteenth is being released in some theaters, I believe. It's also on BET, and you can also rent it from various outlets. This is a film by first-time filmmaker Channing Godfrey Peoples, and it stars Nicole Beharie as a woman who, when she was young, was a pageant star in the Miss Juneteenth pageant. And the Miss Juneteenth pageant is a pageant specifically for young teenage black girls. And it's not just about, like, looking good and, you know, all of those really unsavory things about beauty pageants. It's actually a way to get a really good scholarship. And when she was young, she got that scholarship. But a lot of her life plans were thrown for a loop because she had a child. We now fast forward to the present. Her child is now almost 15 years old. The Miss Juneteenth pageant is coming up again, and she wants to pass on the legacy of sort of her old beauty pageant crown to her daughter, who is not at all enthusiastic about it. This is a wonderful weekend for this film to be released, because this was the first federally mandated Juneteenth holiday.
Well, this one was actually released last year, and it's being re-released this year, right? Because the pandemic, so they wanted to get more eyes on it.
Well, it was at Sundance, I think, and then it was released, limited in theaters during the pandemic, and this is the first time it's widely available.
Yeah.
So, which is why I'm reviewing it now.
Okay. No. It's fine. Just for clarity's sake. Yeah.
Okay. The daughter is played by an actress named Alexis. I'm going to mispronounce this, and I apologize. Alyssa Chikaize, I think, is her name.
Okay.
The legacy of this Miss Juneteenth pageant is really a little bit fraught, because it is very much about black history in the United States, and it is about identifying with that black history as a black person in the United States. I'm not going to speak to that experience. I'm a white guy, but in the course of the film, they talk about how being part of this and acknowledging Juneteenth as an event is a very enriching thing to do. They talk about it as if it's something that will lead to greater things, and they talk about how the people who have won this Miss Juneteenth pageant have gone on to great things and have gone on to like great colleges and become politicians and stuff. Meanwhile, the main character, her name is Turquoise, is trying really, really hard to simply make ends meet. She is, and we spend a lot of time actually not thinking about the pageant and just sort of living with Turquoise and her daughter. Turquoise is still, even though they're separated, she's still occasionally seeing her daughter's father, and they're kind of having an on and off again affair. And she's just sort of taking a lot of odd jobs. She works in a little convenience store. The owner of the convenience store is a good friend of hers. She also works at a mortician's, and that's just another thing. All of the spaces she enters are full of fully realized characters. I always love this when a filmmaker bothers to give personality to even the small characters in a movie.
Yeah.
It's also about her relationship with her mother, her relationship and her mother's relationship specifically with the church, and how there's kind of an indoctrination going on with Christianity with the characters that Turquoise is really not familiar or comfortable with, eventually it's all going to come to a head when there has to be this sort of like coming out ceremony that is in the debutante sense of the teenage daughter who is not into this at all coming out and reading a Maya Angelou poem, and how kind of stifling that experience is, because it feels so forced to her, and she actually really wants to dance. She doesn't want to be, you know, go off to college. It wraps up in an incredibly satisfying way, in that it's not about the triumph you're aiming for. Like we were talking about Monsters University, it's about recognizing the triumphs you've already achieved.
Yeah.
And I really admire when films can dig into that because, you know, we are, as a species, just pretty ambitious. We're constantly looking forward, constantly striving, at least at, you know, modern humanity is a very ambitious creature, and a lot of hope can be found in looking around and taking stock of what you are good at right now and what you're doing right now that is making your life good, and recognizing that what you have been doing and have been seeing as sort of like a Sisyphean task is actually a really satisfying realm of expertise. This is a weird comparison, but I was reminded of Kevin Smith's Clerks 2, which is very much about,
agreed.
If I may, the bliss of stagnating, but I don't have any new ideas, but you know, I'm actually really good right here. And there's a lot of elements of that about, Miss Juneteenth. This is a film that allows the characters to just be, I talked about how in the Super Deep, it's just all padding. There's all these moments, but those aren't moments that are used, that are being used to expand the mood or let us know more about the characters. It's just a slow way of telling a story that doesn't need that much time. Miss Juneteenth is taking that time and letting the characters rest with one another and converse with one another and just be and just work. And it's very vocational and it's very familial and it's very real and it's incredibly touching at the end of the day. It's really, really good.
Great.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
I highly recommend Miss Juneteenth.
Awesome. Well, I'm bummed that I missed that one, so I'm glad you let me know.
Well, I mean, it was around last year. It's around again.
I'm not saying I'll never be able to. Mm. It's just like I wish we could have this conversation today because it sounds like a really wonderful film. Mm. Well, I guess it's time to review some movies then. Mm-hmm. So here at the Critically Acclaimed Network, we review films on a scale of C- to C+. Thus ensuring that we will never be quoted on any posters. And it works thusly. Most movies are a C. They're average. That's the definition of average. Most things are average. So it's got some good, got some bad. Some movies are a C-. That's below average. And for us, that's everything from we just don't particularly recommend it to the worst thing ever made. And then there's some films that are above average. That's a C+. It's just above average. Which means we recommend it. Genuinely and wholeheartedly, whether it's just quite good or the best movie ever made. Whitney Seibold, please review the movie Juneteenth on the critically acclaimed scale.
Miss Juneteenth is a C+. I really was really impressed by this movie.
Awesome. Fatherhood is... I'm torn on Fatherhood because it's good. Okay. It's legitimately good, but it's also a movie that I feel is just... mild enough that I might forget about it later, and that might bring it down to like more C territory.
Yeah.
But fuck it, I'll be nice. It's a C+. It's a well-intentioned movie with a very good lead performance in Kevin Hart, good ensemble cast, sweet, it's touching. It's just might be a little too mild for its own good sometimes. So your mileage might vary. It might not become your favorite thing ever, but I don't think you'll dislike it. So, I guess I have to give it a C+. The Super Deep.
That's a C-.
That's too bad.
Yeah, like, there's ambition here. Well, maybe not a lot, because it isn't, like, a knockoff and really familiar. But, you know, there can be a filmmaker can prove themselves with tested material, and I feel like filmmaker didn't do that here.
That's a shame. Yeah. All right, and last but definitely not least, Pixar's Luca. I'm giving it a big old C+. I think it is a really wonderful film, impeccably designed and crafted and acted. And again, I want to live in this film. Yeah. I want to visit this film. I want this film to succeed. I don't care about financially. I want it to find an audience of people who love its wavelength and care about other people and want things to be nice and meaningful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want that to succeed. I want that to find a future.
I'm giving you a C+ as well. I really enjoyed Luca. If I have any major complaints, it's that I find the two lead voice actors to be just more functional than really full of a lot of personality, but that's such a minor thing.
I mean, I found that there was a little unnecessary emphasis on branding. Half the time they said Vespa, they could have just said scooter. Whatever, it's not really worth getting fight about, and I don't think the portrayal of the uncle is particularly kind, but whatever, I'll let it go. It doesn't ruin the film.
They are sea monsters. They're supposed to look kind of monstrous.
I know, but like we're supposed to look at these sea monsters as stand-ins for us, aren't we? We're supposed to connect to them. And so what's the connection between a big, giant sea monster with a heart problem who always talks about food, and what's the human corollary to that? Not flattering.
I don't recall him talking about food.
He's constantly talking about how in the briny deep where just bits of whale are constantly around you. You just open your mouth and there's constantly food. He talks about it.
I thought that was meant to denote how gross, like there's dead whale falling on your head all day and just how gross it is down there. And undesirable.
I understand. I just think there's, if we're going to make these connections, you got to make them all across the board. I think that one's very flattering. But again, it doesn't hurt the movie. It's one little bit.
I don't have any sort of major nitpicks, though, that kind of tear it apart. Like the fact that you can't pull a guy's hair and make him cook like in Ratatouille. It's like that. That's an absurd detail that kind of distracts from the realism of that movie.
Yeah. As real as the rat who's a brilliant chef movie can be.
Buy the rat as a brilliant chef, but this idea that the rat can also, like, has this magic puppeting power over this person.
That was always silly.
Yeah.
And that was always one bit where it's like, listen, the whole movie falls apart if we can't figure out a way to get for this rat to tell this guy how to cook food. If you can come up with something better before this hits theaters, please let us know. Until then, we're going with the puppet thing because it's a fun visual. That's it. They could. I'm sorry. I don't envy them. That is a tough hurdle to jump over.
So like I like Ratatouille a lot, but that's like one element that's just
so weird.
I know. What? Yeah,
it's so fucking
just
weird.
Just writing around it. It's really bizarre. Same with like Up. It's like, oh, it's a sweet story. Oh, also there's dogs that fly planes. What?
I actually like how weird Up gets. I think the fact that Up gets increasingly weird is all a part of like that man going on that wild journey. Like turns out it was really crazy out there in the world this whole time. Like, it was nuts.
Yeah.
You wouldn't believe it.
I like Up a lot, but, you know, after a while it does lose me. It's like, oh, wait a minute, why is there a Zeppelin? Luca doesn't have any of those, like, cracks. It's just sort of, it's lightweight, but it's still incredibly touching. And I think it does get something really important about being a child.
Yeah.
Correct. I recommend Luca.
All right, so that's it for Critically Acclaimed this week. We'll be back next week with reviews of films like F9,
The F9 of the Furious.
And also the new gangster movie Lansky, and probably some other stuff too.
I got a whole list of films I'm going to try to get through
for that's exciting.
Next week.
I'll be up next week. So thank you everybody for listening. Don't forget, if you miss our Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club segment, it's a whole other podcast. Come by tomorrow. We're talking about the 1979 Walt Disney sci-fi epic box office bomb, The Black Hole, which I'm very excited to talk about. I will say that. Whether it's good or bad, we will talk about tomorrow. But I think it's an interesting film either way. And I think it's worth remembering.
Some things to discuss, anyway.
I think it's worth remembering. And so we'll have that conversation tomorrow. Of course, you can vote for future episodes of that on our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we also have a lot of exclusive shows. We just dropped the latest issue. We just dropped the latest podcast of our Only the Best series. We're reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We just got through the Best Picture nominees of 1941. Yeah, we got a bunch of other stuff there as well. Batman, Star Trek. We're just about to wrap up Star Trek the Animated Series, move on to the movies, and then start reviewing every single episode of Star Trek Next Generation. So there's a giant backlog of those already. So if you join in now for the first time, you're getting like 100 hours of Star Trek podcasts to delve through. And that's all there for your monthly rate. It's a pretty good deal, actually, I think. So thank you everybody who's a patron already. Without you, we couldn't be doing any of these shows. We're really grateful to you. If you want to chime in about anything we discussed on this episode or anything at all, really, there's a couple of ways to do that. You can follow us on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
But if you want your thoughts read aloud on a podcast where we can discuss them for all to hear, you can email us letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. That's our email address. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. And if you're so inclined and you want to write us a letter, or if you wanted to send us anything, some people do, we have a P.O. box that I have not memorized yet. So, Whitney, have at it.
It's the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yep. And if you like luxury soaps, we have a soap store. Head on over to Etsy. Look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. You can also follow Salt Cat Soap, all one word, on Instagram and Twitter. We have a lot of handmade soaps designed by M. Lopez da Silva, my wife and partner. Also some by me. We have a special deal on our Father's Day gift sets. We have a few left over. And so those are on sale until the end of the month. And they're really fancy, and they're inspired by Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So they smell of elderberries, and one of them is inspired by a shrubbery. But they're really, really nice, and I think you'll like them. And after the end of the month, they're gone. That's an exclusive thing that we're not going to... We might do one of them, maybe, but, like, it's exclusive. So, limited edition. And, yeah, I think that's everything. Is that everything?
I think that's everything.
Okay. So, thank everybody listening once again, and never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?